Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well. Hope you had a great 4th and you're staying healthy. In just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Kate Fagan about this remarkable book, All the Colors Came Out. David, you know her better than we do. Tell us a little bit about Kate Fagan.
Well, Kate's a terrific writer. I worked with her in Philly at the Inquirer when she first came in and was covering the Sixers for a couple of years before she went to ESPN. And she's just a terrific humanistic writer. She writes about people rather than games and does a great job of it. And so I've known Kate. Gosh, I guess I met Kate. I was at the Inquirer starting in 2005, so probably 2006 to 2008, and I've known her ever since. And she's just... she's a terrific writer. She played college basketball at Colorado. I think she was played overseas in Europe for a couple of years after that. But, you know, and has been, was a contributor for many ESPN programs, wrote a lot for the website over the years in the magazine. So I was very happy to hear that we were getting her. I wasn't happy that this was the subject matter because it's tough, as we all, as you and I know, and I'm sure most people who are listening know, when you watch a parent die, it's very difficult. It's difficult to deal with. But she writes about it beautifully. It's a great book.
She writes about it beautifully, and it is so much more than the story of helping her family and her father deal with him battling ALS. It's remarkable. She wrote, I don't know if you guys ever read it, but she wrote What Makes Maddie Run, which is New York Times bestseller. It was a story about an incredibly successful, seemingly perfect life runner who committed suicide. To your point, she writes about people. She doesn't really write about the scores on the board. So tonight we got Claude doing all the important work. David, obviously, you just heard him. Jamie McIntyre holding his head early in the show. That worries me a little bit. He's holding his head up. Mm-hmm. Welcome back, Jamie. How are you?
I'm good. Busy as ever.
Good. That's good. Okay. I got to do one thing because we ask people to write reviews on Apple iTunes favorably, and then I never read them. And so I have to read this one from our friend Ed from Michigan. I don't know if Ed wants his last name used. But this is from a few weeks ago, Ed. Sorry about that. While each podcast is structured around a book and its author, it's really about people and their ideas. Ooh, it's like what David just said. Tori Clark recruits top-notch authors who are so surprised, usually pleasantly, that this interview is completely unlike the other dozen they are doing each day on this promotional tour. Prepares us so she can ask unexpected questions, probing the background of the book and the life of the author. So much so that 3/4 of the way through, Jamie McIntyre usually has to say, Tori, why are you going to ask what the book is about? Tori and the co-host can draw on their own broad, fascinating experiences, just the best. So thank you. Thank you, Ed, very much for that. Ed's getting very busy helping to promote Summer of Littles 3.0, which is August 7th. Look it up, summeroflittles.com. So I was reading Ed's review and a few others. David and Jamie, you guys do a lot of work, obviously, that is very public, very visible. How do you feel about social media commentary about your work? David first, then Jamie. Do you read it? You know, Tony Kornheiser obviously never reads.
Necessary evil. Do I read every tweet? I try not to, because you can go down the rabbit hole really quickly and start arguing with some egg that's probably on some, you know, Vladivostok bot farm. It's stupid and I don't want to do it. I try not to, but sometimes people say something that's just so stupid and egregious that you have to comment. You know, most of the people who comment thoughtfully don't do it on social media. They will send you an email. They will send you a text. They will call you.
Do people still call you?
Yeah.
In the old days, 202-334-6000, main number of the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. And if people, if someone has my number and I know them and I know the number when it comes and they have constructive criticism, I'm fine listening to that. And emails always seem to be a little bit more thoughtful. What passes for commentary on most social media is something that I try to avoid.
Yeah. Jamie?
So I completely ignore anything on social media. But like David, I do get emails from time. So when I have a daily newsletter, and in my newsletter is my email. So it's right there. Somebody reads my newsletter and gets mad about something. They email me. I don't get a lot of them. And sometimes they're angry. They're kind of like, you know, I can't believe you're such a jerk and you don't know, you know, a squat about what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And because I don't get a huge volume, I have the luxury of answering the emails. And I always kind of take the same tone, which is I try to see if they have a point, sort of acknowledge what their point is, explain what it was I was trying to do and where I may have fallen short, mm-hmm. and maybe point out some alternate facts. And surprisingly, mm-hmm. I often get a response like, well, I'm sorry I was so nasty in the original. I appreciate you answering. I didn't even expect to get mm-hmm. an answer. Mm-hmm. But of course, as I said, I get such a small volume, I have the luxury of doing that. If I got thousands of emails, obviously I wouldn't have a chance. I would have one of those auto-generated responses yeah. that says, your email means a lot to me. I wish I had time to read it. But, you know, being so famous, I'm too much too busy.
Or the cliche, back in the old days when people would send mail to members of Congress, and 9 times out of 10, they were just bitching about something, right?
Yeah.
And the four-letter answer was, dear sir or madam, you may be right. Sincerely, Congressman. No, just so much. But you would have to look at the, if there was a big volume, you'd have to look at the trends in yeah. those emails and say, okay, is it worth addressing or not?
Yeah. But, you know, this is why so many places, including the organization that I work for, the Washington Examiner, early on disabled comments on the stories.
Yeah.
Because what would happen is they would just descend into these flame wars of people, and they would get off the subject, and then somebody would be advertising their new natural mineral supplements in the comments, and what would happen is you would write an interesting or controversial article, and then immediately the first response would be someone saying this is completely wrong, and then somebody else saying you'd write an article that said the Earth was round, and then someone would say no, that's absolute nonsense. The right. Earth is flat. And then there'd be a big argument about that. And no one would even know what to think about your article.
So, yeah.
The level of discourse on social media can be somewhat discouraging at times. I have to admit, though, I read a lot of stuff. There's a lot of smart people who are constantly posting their analysis of what just happened. Some of them are snarky. Some of them are actually amusing. So I do read a lot of the stuff on Twitter, but I try not to respond to anything myself.
Yeah. Well, sublime to ridiculous, reverse of sublime to ridiculous. So what, about 10 days ago, Jamie, Don Rumsfeld passed away. And I really do appreciate, I realize there's a lot of difference of opinion about Don mm-hmm. Rumsfeld. And mm-hmm. I really appreciate friends like David who checked in and said, you know, sorry, a friend of yours has died. And he was a good friend and his family are good friends and we'll miss him terribly, but not without his controversies. And soon after it was announced that he had died, my son Colin comes over to my house and says, you cannot look at social media. I'm taking your phone. You cannot look at social media. And as the day went on, and there might have been a few beers and a few shots, and then we had Russ the Corgi we had to deal with, my phone was taken away from me because I would have come. I don't have the self-control that you need to deal with the criticism in social media.
So I wrote an obituary for him for the Washington yeah. Examiner, which of course I had written about a year ago. So I had taken a lot of time to write it, and I tried to make it very balanced. And one of the things that one of the people on social media commented to me was they said they really appreciated that the very last line of my obituary was a little paragraph in which Rumsfeld had been asked how he wanted to be remembered. And I quoted him as talking about, you know, you make a lot of decisions. They're not all perfect. And the person wrote me and said, you know, I just appreciate you giving him the last word in your obituary. And I wrote another piece that was a little more personal about Rumsfeld and me and the things. And I think I said in that piece that I said that he was both the most revered and the most reviled defense secretary of his time. And I, you know, and how much the people who worked for him and worked intimately with him really respected him and thought he was a person of the highest integrity. And then there were lots of other detractors who believe he's a war criminal and has blood on his hands. And the thing I wrote about when I was talking about him personally, and I was telling stories about interactions I'd had with Rumsfeld over the years, I said, you know, I'm not a Rumsfeld detractor. I'm not a Rumsfeld booster, but I am a Rumsfeld admirer. And I admired a lot of the way he handled things, the way he analyzed problems. And there was never a doubt in my mind that his ambition was to do the absolute best for the country. However, some of the policies turned out.
Yeah. I got an exceptional number of emails from reporters that were, you know, in that when I was at the Pentagon and you were there, Jamie, you know, your colleagues, an exceptional number of emails from people saying, hey, I mean, essentially that saying, look, lots of people can disagree with what he did, how he did, but he really was doing what he thought was best. Something that came through a lot was, and it was true, his care for the men and women in uniform and their consequences and their circumstances. But let's pretend this is a podcast about books. So three books, Known Unknowns, and I had a big role to play in the title of that book. I said it had to be the title of that book. Rumsfeld Rules, and then a book that there were lots of different reasons. When it came out, Rumsfeld was sick. I think he had a horrible battle with shingles or something like that. Mm. But when this, the book about Gerald Ford, and I continue to say, let's, you know, distract a little bit here, Gerald Ford, one of the most important consequential presidents of all time. Sure. And that book was remarkable. And it had information in there and it had research in there that had never been seen before. It had letters and documents that had never been seen before that Rumsfeld put in that book. And I always thought it was a shame because he was sick at the time. He couldn't get out there and promote that book.
So that that book was called, I think, When the Center Held.
Gerald Ford and the Rescue of the American Presidency.
Right. So I asked Rumsfeld about, you know, When the Center Held, was is that some reference to what was going on in the election when the sort of moderates seemed to prevail? And he said, no, he said in college, Ford was a center on the football team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it is a terrific book. And like Known Unknowns, it's extremely well-documented. And so it really adds to the historical record. There's somebody picks up the book. There's a part in there in particular about Joe Biden and his role in the Senate when the discussion under the Ford administration about repatriating and rescuing Vietnamese after the fall of Saigon, which is particularly relevant to today. But, you know, you left out a book. You left out the book was one of my favorites.
Go ahead.
Okay. It's called Pieces of Intelligence. Do you have this book?
The
book came out. So this was some folks who apparently they'd done this before with the selected verse of Phil Rizzuto. they took actual verbatim quotes from Rumsfeld from various briefings and press conferences and arranged them in the form of sort of free verse. And they really do look like poetry and they really read like poetry.
Yeah, too. It's pretty great. I promise we'll move on. And I see Kate's popped up on the screen here. Okay, Jamie, what's our, as in I let you be on the show, our favorite story from Known Unknown from September 11th, which involves yours truly. Okay, for those who can't see us on Zoom, there's just a blank stare in Jamie McIntyre's face. So 9/11, and we're coming up on the 20th anniversary, which is stunning to me. I am still wearing effing clothes that I had then, so it doesn't seem that long ago. But anyway, it's kind of a busy day. There's a lot going on. And when things really started happening in the first few hours, you know, I got a hold of my husband, Brian. I said, get the kids out of the school, those kinds of things. Jamie, I'm sure you checked in with Roberta, right? Kind of thing. And other people in the senior staff, you'd say, okay, yeah, you checked in with your, great, fine. And a couple of times during the day, as we were doing things, I'd say to Rumsfeld, hey, have you checked in with I called her JR, I refused to call her Joyce, but I said, JR, Joyce Rumsfeld, your wife. And he's like, no, busy. The day goes on, and two or three or four times during the day, I'd say, have you, and I knew where she was, and I had checked in with her, but I said, have, and he's no, and he's like, waves me off. So late that night, he went over to the White House for a meeting, came back, I don't know, Jamie, 11:30, something like that, comes back, and we're sitting in his office, and we're doing some stuff, and I looked at him, and I said, have you checked in with JR? Please tell me you've checked in with JR. He looked up, and he goes, no. I was like, you cold, heartless son of a bitch. He was shocked. He was shocked that it wasn't Mr. Secretary. It wasn't sir. It was you cold, heartless son of a bitch. There might have been an F word in there, too. But I think that turned into a uniquely bonding experience after that.
Did he pick up the phone and call JR after that?
No, not a bit. Not a bit. Yep. And I talked to her about it after, and she goes, it never occurred to her. She knew he was okay and alive. He knew that she was alive and okay. And every... One of the most remarkable, that's the book that should have been written. One of the most remarkable marriages ever. Talk about a partnership and just two really, really unique people. Okay, I was going to talk about West Virginia giving books out, but because I could rave about Dolly Parton, but I won't do that. And my son Colin has said he's sick and tired of me gushing about Dolly Parton. I will never stop.
After you meet your future husband.
One of these days, David. I'm working on my travel schedule for next year, and so it could be arranged. We're never going back to the tech giants book list because I hate those. And we're going to talk to Kate Fagan. Hi, Kate Fagan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. Welcome to Chatter on Books.
Yeah. Hello, Kate Fagan.
You and David want to catch up?
Who are you?
That's funny. It's good to see David Aldridge because I still feel and remember that when I started the Sixers beat, he was the first person on like a national level to really welcome me and open his arms and support me. And so every time I think of David Aldridge or see him, I think of the graciousness with which he carried himself.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
Did you both live in Philadelphia? And if so, where?
I lived in Philly for 3 years and I covered the 76ers for the Philadelphia Inquirer, but David at that time, if I remember correctly, you'd already moved on to TNT.
It's so weird. I worked at the Inquirer for 4 years. I never moved to Philly. I simply spent much of those 4 years driving back and forth on 95. Like you would go, I mean, Kate knows how crazy a sports town Philly is. So at the time, the Eagles were going to the Super Bowl. The Phillies were going to the World Series. The Flyers were not as good, but people loved the Flyers. The Sixers were not boring. They had just come off of the Iverson years. So there was, and there's, you know, Villanova and college basketball. Yeah. So every week, 3 or 4 times a week, I'm up to Philly and back, up to Philly. And it's just what you did. And because I was young and stupid then, I could do it.
And driving was easier than the train, right?
Sometimes I took the train, but most of the time I drove just because it was easier. It's a 2-hour drive if you hit it right. And so it wasn't too bad. But I love Philly as a town. I came to love the people in that town. They're very smart and passionate about their sports. There's a small percentage that are Cro-Magnon, but I don't think it's as bad as people make it out to be. Most of them know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So I liked it very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's my Philadelphia author story, because I try to make this show about books occasionally. So I used to go to Philadelphia all the time. When I worked for Comcast, I was there all the time. I worked for SAP, and the North American headquarters was in Newton Square. So I'm up there a lot. And it's a rainy Friday, late afternoon, early evening. I'm, you know, over at 30th Street Station, schlepping around, waiting for the train to bring me back home, and go into the little, you know, newsstand place to get a Diet Coke and some magazines, whatever. And again, it's a rainy day in Philadelphia, and set up in that little newsstand store in the corner is this sad little folding table that was kind of tilted, and this sad looking man sitting there with a bunch of books in front of him. It was an author event, right? But he was just sitting there trying to sell his books. And I felt sorry for him. I walked by and I look over and I said, oh, what, you selling a book? And he says, yeah. And it's a book and it's got this dog on it. And I said, what's it about? Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, I had about 95 different books that I was supposed to write. And I was working on books. And my editor or my publisher just got tired of me always telling stories about my dog. So I wrote a book about my dog and it's going to be a disaster. And I said, oh, it looks really cute. I felt so sorry for the guy. I bought 10 copies.
Luckily, launched it
on the train, right, in whatever bag I had. I'm schlepping these books home and I'm handing them out to people on the train and things like that. Effing Marley and Me.
Yep.
Of course.
Marley and Me. Philadelphia Inquirer, right? Philadelphia
That's
Inquirer.
Right. Yeah. The first year I was there, one of the first times I went into the office because I didn't, as a beat writer, I wasn't often in the office, right, but they were filming a scene with Owen Wilson.
Oh.
In the offices. So it was right when that movie was being made. But did that book have a slow start? Did it not take off immediately? I don't even know.
I don't know how early in the start this was, but he was ready to commit suicide. Right? His wife was angry with him. It was a disaster. I mean, it wasn't even a tablecloth and table. It was this sad little folding table tilted to the side. Okay. All right, Kate Fagan, we're going to talk about you. David knows you well, but not everybody listening to this podcast knows you well. So let's see what Wikipedia got right. Born in Rhode Island.
Born there. Yes, born there.
went to, and I'm going to mispronounce it, Niskayuna High School.
You didn't. You did well. Niskayuna.
Niskayuna. Okay. There are famous alumni from Niskayuna. Do you know them?
Sure. I mean,
who do you know? Who are the other famous alumni? Because you make it on Wikipedia as a famous
alumni. Jeff Blatnick was an Olympic gold medal wrestler.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember him. Sure.
Andre Davis was an NFL wide receiver. Yeah. But here's the big one. Here's the big one. Brian Chesky, the co-founder of Airbnb.
That's pretty huge.
That's the
wow.
one.
That's yep. the one. Yeah. That? Yeah. Pull it. You got a Pulitzer Prize winner, Gilbert King, who wrote a great book about Thurgood Marshall.
Mm, Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah. Pulitzer Prize winner in 2013 for nonfiction. Yeah, but I'm with you. Airbnb is the biggest one. Okay.
He was a classmate of mine. So, yeah.
What was he like?
He was a soccer player, like kind of in the group of kids who were like not super popular, but like were friends with everybody.
Uh-huh.
I remember finding out he was the co-founder of Airbnb and being very surprised because he didn't strike me as the entrepreneurial type. But again, I don't know what that even means now that I realized that. So we were all like, wow, Brian Chesky. Oh my God. But so he surprised all of us. He wasn't like, oh, that's the guy who's definitely going to be big in business and make it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
David, most famous person in your high school class. I think it's you, right?
In my class?
In your class. I think it's you.
I mean, fame is, it's such a
ridiculous
concept. No, it is. It's stupid. I don't know.
Probably not. Okay, stop talking. Jamie McIntyre, most famous person in your class.
The most famous person in my class of 1971 and the former T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria was the entire football team,
which
a movie was made about, starring Denzel Washington.
I didn't know that was your class.
Class of 71. So,
wow, that's huge.
I went back to my class reunion, 20-year class reunion, and I was really pumped because like the other people you were talking about, nobody expected me to make anything of myself. I barely
right.
And I was riding high because I had a local show on Channel 9 called Capital Edition. I was the host of the show. I was, the star. And about 2 months before the reunion, they canceled the show and I was unemployed.
Okay, we have to do that. Kate, we'll come back to you, I promise. Once a year, Jamie, we have to tell my favorite story about Jamie McIntyre. WTOP, Reagan gets shot.
Oh, you're pretty much spot. I didn't really...
Yeah.
There's so many stories about this. Is this the one where I got
it? You declared him dead.
Yeah.
Oh, that didn't
I learned a really valuable lesson then, because back then I was a young reporter and I was in awe of CBS. And we were a CBS radio affiliate, and I'm standing by to do a live report from the hospital. And just before the anchor on the air, Jamie Bragg, another famous Jamie, throws to me, he says, wait, we have a special report coming in from CBS. And CBS says, this is a CBS Net Alert report. And they said, we have just gotten word from Capitol Hill that White House Press Secretary James Brady has succumbed from his wounds.
Oh, right. Jim Brady.
And then they go back to him. And then Jamie Bragg throws it to me and said, well, now let's go to our guy at the GW Hospital, Jamie. And I say, as you just heard, on CBS, James Brady has died from his wounds, but the president is still in surgery. And I go on and I end my report. And another reporter is sitting next to me in a car running two-way radio. And he says to me, I wouldn't have said that if I were you. I wouldn't have said James Brady died. I would have said, we can't confirm that from here. And I said, well, but he died. So, I just didn't want to sound stupid, like I didn't know what was going on. And of course, he hadn't died. And then from that moment on, as a reporter, I learned that you never go on what somebody else says. You go with, and the correct answer is my friend advised me to say, we can't confirm that from here, but here's what we know. And you sound a lot less stupid that way. Big lesson that I carried with me the rest of my journalism career.
Good. Okay. Once a year, we'll ask you to tell that story because it's just so fun. Okay, Kate, back to you. And I promise we're going to talk a ton about this book, All the Colors Came Out, which is fabulous. As David and I were saying at the start of the show, Kate, it's about so much more than you think it is, which is great. But your dad played basketball. You played basketball, high school, college, Colorado. You played Europe, right? Dave Kindred, who is just an icon in our world, he's been on the show with his great book, Leave Out the Tragic Parts. Had a question for you. He says, what will I see today in women's basketball that was not there in your time at Colorado and in the WNBL?
Wow. Well, I am honored to have a question from Dave. He's always been he's a great writer and a great supporter on so many levels. You would see the evolution of the game. I've talked about it with Dawn Staley, the U.S. women's national team coach, South Carolina coach. Anybody who I know played around the time I played, we always talk about the skill level, the athleticism, simply the space that the players take up now. It's unlike anything I played against. You know, of course you have different, you know, you have different training, you have all of those things are different. So you can't compare generations, but who I was then as a player, I couldn't play in this game because of because of the evolution of it. And the men's game is also evolving, but I think the women's game has evolved a little bit faster in the last 10 to 15 years because it had more room to evolve because of more recent support into it than had been in previous generations. So it's impossible to single it out because every single part of it has evolved to a place that is borderline unrecognizable, the game that they're playing now.
Wow. David, agree?
It's funny that you should bring this up because I went to Saturday night, I went to the Chicago Sky Mystics game in Chicago because it's close by. And a friend of mine got us tickets. First time I had ever sat courtside for anything in 35 years of doing this job. Kate is so right. The defense is so good now. You just can't even it's so good. I mean, I was in awe of how good defensively both teams were and just the communication, the switchability and that's a trend in all of basketball is that you have to be able to guard everybody on the floor. It doesn't matter who your person is that you're supposed to be guarding. There's a screen. You have to guard somebody else now and everybody has to do it. And if you can't do it, you can't play. And so people just switch all the time now and it's phenomenal. The game is the skill level is much better. Everything's better. And Kate's right. It's the same for the men, but maybe not as steep a climb, but yeah, it's great. The game is in terrific hands right now.
Is that for you sporty people? is that true in most sports? And the reason I ask that, the only thing is Dave and Jamie know, Kate, I know it tiny bit is about the horse world and, you know, Grand Prix jumping, that kind of thing. And the kids now, the 18 and under crowd, right, who are supposedly learning and training and trying to become the big professionals, et cetera, are doing things now that are so difficult and so technical that I've heard course designers and professionals say, you know, that was, you know, that's harder than Olympic level 25, 30, 40 years ago. Right. So the Olympic level riders of 25, 30 years ago could not compete against the best junior competitors now. And that's how much the sport has evolved. So is it true in all sports or is it in just some of these bigger ones or in the horse world where they just spend millions of dollars?
I mean, every sport that I pay attention to evolves somewhat like this, just because you look at the NBA or in that, I'll use that example. And obviously David and I know that well, when there's that amount of money, ability to exploit even the smallest degree of advantage. You know, you'll read about people who, you know, juice beets because they think it'll absorb oxygen better. You know, anybody who has homed in on a sliver of an advantage is going to exploit it.
Yeah.
So yes, that's happening in every sport. I would say that I think on women's soccer, women's basketball, the trajectory has been a little steeper because of the previous lack of resources. Yeah. And so you're seeing that curve a little bit faster.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about evolution. So you evolved from an athlete, including being a professional athlete at a very high level, being covered by people like David Aldridge and Jamie McIntyre you become a journalist and you are the coverer. Why did you make that shift? And how did you find the culture differences?
I made the shift very strategically in that I always wanted to be a writer. And at the outset of my post-playing career, I would have said, and I still think this, that I wanted to write books and novels and screenplays. But I also knew I hadn't focused on anything in my life other than basketball. So I majored in something that just allowed me to play basketball. And I didn't have the skill set at that time, nor did I have the resources to say, okay, I'm just going to write a book now.
Right.
And I, after having certain conversations, and I'd gotten to know the Boulder Daily Camera beat writers who covered us, and I would then in turn talk to them about the business and writing. And it became very clear to me that the clearest path for me toward writing eventually and getting paid and learning was sports writing, because I had the advantage of knowing the world and knowing in particular basketball really well, that I thought I would have a leg up on it. So it was strategic in that it wasn't my end goal to be a sports journalist, but I knew it was the right next step to learn more about writing, to learn more about, you know, being in a business world as opposed to coming from basketball. I still have a hard time with the fact that I'm the coverer and not the coveree, because I remember being annoyed at having journalists there. I remember all of that. I remember feeling like the questions could be better, right? And this is from the small sample size that I had as women's basketball player, certainly not the kind of coverage that you see with men in other sports. So I'm still very wary of crossing lines in terms of, like, you know, having to call somebody and ask for things and spend their time. I'm very judicious with that, which I think is both an asset, because I develop good relationships because I don't burn them and I don't ask for too much. But at the same time, I'm not going to be a great newsbreaker because I'm not going out of my way to call people and, like, hound them for stuff. So it's worked both to my, you know, advantage and then, you know, deficit at certain steps along the way.
Jamie, empathy for the covered, as someone who was covered by you, empathy.
Most reporters, when they find themselves to be the object of a story somehow, begin to realize why so many people. I always told my wife, if I was taken hostage somewhere and I was suddenly the thrust of a story, that she was not to let any of the TV crews onto our property. to the point to go down and talk to them, because she don't have to talk to these people and don't let them on the property. I've seen TV crews, like, trample fences to get shots and stuff. So yeah. So when you're on the other side, it looks a little differently.
David, empathy.
Oh, sure. I've always said that what the great failing of sports journalism throughout my career, and I'm part of that, I have to own part of that failure, is that we have never adequately explained how fucking hard it is to be a professional athlete. Like, it's really hard. Like, it's really not easy to do. And everybody thinks, oh, I could get a game off of Serena. No, you couldn't. You couldn't get a serve return. No, you couldn't. I could play with Tiger. No, you can't. There's so much better. I always make this analogy, and Kate, I'm sure, understands this. In the NBA or the WNBA, any sports league, if you could quantify somehow who the worst player was in that league, the worst player in that league is better than 99% of everybody who ever played the sport. they just are. You know? And we never explain that to people. We make it seem like anybody could come up, roll off their couch and play professionally. And you can. So you're not.
On the other hand, when it comes to journalism, pretty much anybody could roll off the couch.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, literally anybody could roll
off the couch. No qualification.
We do.
Whatever you can get away with.
Yeah. I always thought, I'll use the Pentagon as an example. On any given day, what you might see on the evening news, you might see in the, you know, front page, right? Or the most covered thing about the Pentagon was, Jamie knows this, the tiniest, tiniest little fraction of everything that had happened that day. Yeah. And then you think about athletes, obviously you who are covering the games and the teams and the leagues, you're going to focus on the very, very top of that, right? The most important part, who won which game, those kinds of things. So much goes into it. To your point, David, the least talented player has put in decades of work, has worked 30 hours already that week before they even have the first game or the 5 minutes on the court or on the field. So much goes into what you actually see in the journalistic output, yeah. I guess it is. And there's no way to ever capture that because it's too boring to capture all of that.
Hey, Tori, we're pretty yes, far into the program.
Now, should we ask about the show? Okay, I mean the book.
Is it time for me to ask the Jamie question?
It's time to ask the Jamie question about, and I have a question about the cover because it's beautiful. All the colors came out by Kate Fagan. Go Jamie McIntyre.
So this is the point where I ask you, Kate, what's the book about?
that's the question you're tasked with asking.
Yes. Right. So
somehow we always get off on a tangent, and I always like to bring it back to recognizing that we have an author who's actually created a book, and maybe we should tell the people what it's about.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. All the colors came out. My elevator pitch for it is that it's like Tuesdays with Maury meets Hoop Dreams. That's kind of, you know, but then you got to assume that everybody knows what Hoop Dreams is, which might be a little myopic for us sports people. But so it's like Tuesdays with Maury. It's a story about the last year of my dad's life and leaving ESPN to be with him and learning the lessons, not just of what that year taught me and what it was like watching him face his end and in this disease, but also taking that year and looking back on what he had taught me on the basketball court and as a kid growing up. So I try to infuse the book with all these lessons, both on the court and off, that he taught me. And at the same time, hopefully get people to take a look at their priorities, that achievement culture, its place in our world, and being able to prioritize the people who have helped shape us, you know, at their end, and what we want from those interactions and that time.
David and I talked a little bit before we started taping. I was surprised by this book, pleasantly surprised. But David, your reaction, your first reaction to the book?
I wasn't surprised because I know Kate. I know she's brilliant, and she would write with a 360-degree view of that entire time, which is both, you know, outreaching, here's what happened, but introspective as well. You know, all of us, well, Tori and I in the last year both lost parents, and it's indescribable. It's indescribable. And so reading this book, I just thought about so many, yeah, that happened to us too. And here's what, and it was poignant, but not maudlin, I think would be the way I would put it. It was frank, and just moving. And what I got out of it was that it was about two people that really loved each other. And I thought that was really cool.
Part of the surprise for me is, and I'm going through the first few chapters and go, oh my God, this is a great relationship between a father and a daughter. Your dad played basketball, including professional ball overseas. You grew up playing basketball, loving it, spending an extraordinary amount of time with him, and he would shoot hoops with you. He'd let you play in the guy's pickup game, for God's sake. And in many ways, it seems like it would be the perfect relationship, but it became more complicated. Right, Kate?
Yeah. And I think that's at the heart of the book is that, and David's right, I think maybe a quicker elevator pitch is like, this is a love letter to my dad. You know, that it is a love story between us, just a different kind of one. But to your point, Tori, I think that I think everyone's relationships with people in their nuclear family, and I think I can say this unequivocally, like life dings them and dents them. Even the best of those relationships over the years, there's interactions, there's things said, there's choices made that shape it, that hurt it, that we regret, that we need to go back to, even the best relationships. And so I think this book, I tried to tell a story of a father and a daughter, but you could replace any relationship dynamic in it. And it's not so dramatic that we were estranged, right? It's not, we didn't talk for 15 years, we had some huge falling out. No, I think it's much more universal than that. This is a relationship that, yeah, we talked all the time, but were there periods of time where those conversations didn't get us very far or very deep?
Yeah.
And I think people can relate to that. They can relate to, yeah, I talk to so-and-so all the time, but I know deep down, I can feel that there's things I need to say. There's There's apologies I need to make. There's moments I regret. And will I say those things? Will I take the time? Will I have the time?
Mm-hmm.
And those were all parts that I wanted to examine in writing this book. And yes, yeah, it's through the lens of my, you know, it's through the relationship with my dad, but through those details, I hope, and I think there's universality in it, even though it's, you know, it's about the 90s Knicks, but replace anything, right? Replace anything right. You loved with the person that you loved.
But it's also about another relationship, one that we all have, which is our relationship with our growing sense of mortality and how we think we might approach death and how we might deal with it and how we kind of fantasize how we hope it's going to be and what it's really like. And the tough part, and I think about Donald Rumsfeld when I think about this, about somebody who is really vital, athletic, great shape, terrific. And then, you know, inevitably you've got to confront death. I'm the age now that Rumsfeld was when he first became defense secretary, and I didn't think he was very old at all. Of course, that was 20 years ago. But
second time around.
The first time I was in high school. But talk a little bit about how did your father deal with this? I mean, he, in a way, you had the luxury of knowing that things were coming and that you could sort of start to deal with them. It wasn't a sudden thing, but talk about how that dynamic played out.
Yeah. One undercurrent of the book, I do think, is an athlete facing mortality, because the world of sports, you just, when you're in them, the vibrancy, the youth, the vitality that is a part of our sports world, especially the one we cover so heavily, like, you know, the NBA, the NFL, the idea of death in our culture is we don't talk about it enough to begin with, let alone in the sports world where it's, you know, you never give up. And that was a big undercurrent of the book, is you never give up. And my dad came from that athletic background, and he took that mentality and he applied it to how he wanted to face ALS. But as I try to write in the book, that never surrender, that doesn't work for everything. And that's not always the courageous decision, even though that's the way we frame it so often in our regular world and our sports world. And I tried to kind of tease some of that out with the way he approached death and the flaws that I saw in it. But another big focus I wanted to have in the book was not making a hero of my dad, and not perpetuating this idea that everybody who's in those last months of their life are going to reach this like peaceful Zen philosophical state. Because I think a lot of the writing that has been done, and not all of it, but a lot of it, can feel as if everyone who's in those final months sees this like Buddhist clarity. And I really did, I consumed a lot of that writing and movies. And there were times when I was pretty mad at my dad when he would be bitter or angry, or when he would say something that didn't fit this idea of like pure of heart and generosity that I think you should find at your end. And so it was important to me in writing this book that I addressed the athletic nature of like, what is weakness and what is surrender? And then also trying to write a very honest portrait of death and of him, and not just cut out the messy parts and really show him as a whole. And that was so important to me, because I didn't want people to read my version of this book, and then when they were in this situation, expect their loved one to be perfect. Because I definitely wanted my dad to be, I definitely thought my dad should be better than he was, right? I didn't want him to say mean things. I didn't want him to say bitter things. I was like, you should be better than this. But most people facing death, at least now that I've talked to a lot of my friends, like, you have those moments. Even if you have the wonderful, peaceful moments, you also have the bitter moments, but we don't necessarily capture those as often.
Yeah. And you get a pass. I think people in those places get a pass. I'm just saying. The whole, I don't want to give too much away about the book, but your whole addressing of surrendering, and that surrendering becomes the bravest thing. mm-hmm. was just extraordinary. And I really, you know, I know you say you don't want to say he was a hero, and we throw that word around way too much, especially in Washington, D.C. But boy, even at the end, when he had great difficulty communicating and would communicate by blinking his eyes, there was some tremendous compassion in there and yes. some efforts to reach you and address some things that had not been addressed in this yeah. remarkably interesting, wonderful relationship that you had.
Yeah.
I was bawling. I was completely bawling. I was reading on the plane on my way to Iceland and I was dying. And then I listened to it, which was a really bad mistake because then I was crying again. Talk about your mom a little bit. I loved her forward to the book.
Yeah.
And then if you
I
get
know
to
where the writing comes from. Shit, that was
yeah, no kidding.
Fantastic.
And then you get to the one of the questions I had written down early on was to ask you, when did you decide to write the book? And I thought there's going to be some incredible moment. You're taking care of your dad and it occurs to you and you start taking notes. But 2 months after he died, you went to your mom and said, how would you feel about me reading a book? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Writing a
yeah.
book?
Yeah, I didn't. Maybe deep down somewhere, because I have written nonfiction books and I am a journalist, I certainly, during that last year of his life, if he said something or we had a moment, I didn't write it down, but I tried to absorb it very deeply. But uh-huh. I wasn't consciously thinking, I'm going to write a book about this.
Right.
It was after he died and those days afterward that I started writing down things that I remembered of him. You know, the day after he died, we created a word document, just like free word association sure. of everything that reminded us of dad. And that was probably the beginning of trying to think of it more of a story.
Uh-huh.
And I asked my mom a couple months afterward. I live in Charleston, South Carolina, and she was visiting. And I knew that if I wanted to write this book, I would want to write it with complete honesty of the things I thought, the things I said, mm-hmm. because I remember worrying that I was a little bit like a monster at various points in the things I was thinking. But I was very hopeful that in those moments where I felt like a monster, there would be millions of people who recognized those thoughts in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I asked my mom, you know, do you think that this is a book that you would support and that dad would want me to write? I wanted 100% backing from her because I was about to write things that you probably shouldn't be writing.
mm-hmm.
And I thought that was the only way to do this book in a way that set it apart somehow. Otherwise it was just going to be sure. one of 100 books that you could pick up. And I wanted it to be not that we can ever do anything fully new, but I wanted this to write the book that I wish that I had read going into that last year with my dad.
Can yeah, you explain the title? Where's the source of the title?
It's from the U2 song Beautiful Day. And my dad, one of probably about 5 songs that my dad just loved and he would play frequently in the morning was Beautiful Day. And it was one of 5 songs that we put on his, you know, the collection of photos you play at someone's wake. And yeah. I just wanted a title that felt more poetic. So I looked through the lyrics of all of his favorite songs and A lot of Springsteen got perused. A lot of Peaky Blinders songs. There's big Peaky. So, but
so great that he's a Peaky Blinders fan. That's so
that's
great.
Right.
But very
that,
very
that's hip. Right. That was the lyric that kind of stood out to me as representative of what I was trying to write in the book.
Yeah. Okay. David touched on this, but I felt this reading it. I went, wow. I wish I had read this before my family went through what we went through with my mother, then with my dad. And David, I know you went through some of the same things. And I've heard just when people heard we were going to have you on the show and we were going to be talking about your book, people have reached out to me saying, you know, boy, I've read it. It was such an inspiration to me. It was so helpful to me, those kinds of things. You must be hearing from so many people, including families of people going through ALS, right?
Yes, definitely the ALS community, because there's a, you know, there's a reason for them to pick this book up. Now yeah. in their lives. Whereas I think that the book it's a tougher sell than a lot of books because there's a huge percentage of people who, unless they're dealing with something or they have just gone through something, they don't necessarily want to be in this headspace. Even
right.
though I don't think the book is a downer. I know
not
it's
at all.
Yeah. I do know that it's an emotional book, but I think it's I want it to read more like a beautiful reflection of life and these times rather than just a maudlin version of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, the being able to connect with the ALS community has been really valuable, both for me and my mom, because it's just the kind of disease that once you've had it in your life, you're always going to be a champion for finding a cure and for connecting with people who are in it, because it changes your life. When you're in it, yeah, it completely upends your life. And then afterward, like, you're never the same, and you always want to connect with people who are touched by ALS. Yeah.
So it, David, I want you to jump in here. Mm-hmm. Your dad getting sick, and you're stepping back from a very high profile role at ESPN. And you made a conscious decision, Kate, that you wanted to spend time with him and be with your family to help go through that. It changed your trajectory, your life trajectory, right? And for the better, are you happy? And the horrible reason to change your trajectory, the kind of career you were pursuing. And I think Jamie and David and Claude and I can all relate to people pursuing their careers and being very ambitious. Mm-hmm. Are you happy that for a terrible reason, your life took a different trajectory and you're focused on different things now?
Yes. And that's been very heartening for me to see, because when I finally made the decision to leave ESPN, I had to reconcile within myself that maybe this would hurt my career. Uh-huh. And I wasn't worried, I wasn't upset at that, but I did have to say to myself, well, you know, you're making this decision for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
And this is something you would never regret doing. Of course, I talked to everybody and they're like, you're never going to regret spending this time with your dad. But I did think, well, it could hurt my career and I may never get to whatever that place, quote unquote, is again, but that's the chance I'm willing to take. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've learned through all this is, like, we have this lie that we're, you know, we're not knowingly perpetuating when we're like, you stepped off the track as if that's the only track, right? Or you got off the career ladder. And so then if you got off, like, well, apparently you have to start at the bottom again. Or I just, all of that stuff just, when you make decisions for what I think are just the human focused reasons, not always, but I feel like you end up in a place where, like, you've become a better person. You're seeing the world a little bit differently, especially in our media world. People want people who have had different life experiences than just focused on sports for 20 years. It's like, well, no, in order to write the better stories, you have to have lived life and be able to see the different angles in the people that you're writing about. And so it's been heartening to know that I can do this that I think was for the right reasons, and also come out on the other side and feel like I wasn't, quote unquote, like, harmed by it, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I remember at the finals in Cleveland, so this would have been 2018, I was thinking about changing jobs because I wanted to be home more, and I wanted to be home. My dad was 90 at the time. and you knew you had to, it was time. And my kids were getting older. And I remember talking to somebody, and he may not ever remember this, and telling him, oh, I'm thinking about this. And he said, well, why are you thinking about it? And I don't know if I'm going to do this. Well, you know, what would it do? And I told him everything that I thought would happen, that I'd get to be home more. I'd get to be in front of my kids more. I get to be there with my dad more. And he said, why are you asking me this? You've already made up your mind. Like, you know what to do. Just do it. Just pull the trigger already, you know? And it's hard, though, because, and again, as Kate writes beautifully in the book, ambition is a hell of a drug, man. I mean, it really is. Yeah. Like, you really think the league's not going to be able to go on without you.
You know, every time I hear someone say, you know, decision is so hard, I don't know what the right thing to do is, more times than not, it's really clear what the right thing to do is. Yeah. The hard thing is doing it.
Yeah.
Making that decision and sort of jumping because you don't know what the consequences, how it's going to play out.
Sure.
Yeah. In your world and in the Washington, D.C. world, in your book, Kate, you talk about, you always had to say yes. Say yes. And every time they offered you a new show or a new you know, get to host this show. Say yes, say yes. Jamie, you lived that at CNN. Always say yes. And don't say no, because there were 1,500 knuckleheads who would be happy to have that 2 minutes on and Friday night at 11 p.m. to talk about something stupid or whatever. So easy to say yes, much harder to say no. One of the greatest interviews I ever saw was with Sheryl Crow many years ago. She got breast cancer. And she did this in an incredibly compassionate way. And she says, having breast cancer gave her the first ability she ever had in her career to say no. Because mm-hmm. that was her, and I think, a terrible wand. What did you call it in the book, Kate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it was a great line. I'll remember it at 3 o'clock in the morning. But it gave her the ability to say no, which is a very powerful thing. Okay, we got a little bit of housekeeping. Hey, Claude, can you talk about Patreon? Do our Patreon shtick.
No, absolutely. People should sign up for Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chatteronbooks. You get all the exclusive feature. We just did a 60 seconds more. If you listen to the show, you're not a Patreon member, you have no clue what that is, because you've got to sign up for Patreon in order to hear that. Kate Fagan. Also, we have our virtual book club that you're a part of. And also, you get to watch the show live once a month. And all kinds of, like, we didn't do a show last week because of the 4th of July holiday, but Tori did some exclusive content and bonus content just for Patreon. So you get a lot of good stuff.
You were in person, right?
Exactly. And I'll do a chatter on travel, my reports from Iceland. Great country. Absolute great country. Okay, we are back. Hang on, Kate. Stay with us, because you're going to be part of Deserted Island. We are back next week with Miles Copeland, and I am really looking forward to this. Miles Copeland is a name some people would know because, among other things, he managed Sting and Police, mega record producer. He did Fine Young Cannibals, the Bangles. When I got to know him, he was the largest developer and distributor of Arab music in the Western world. He created the World Belly Dance Superstars. Don't laugh. It is spectacular. His father, Miles Copeland Jr., was one of the original heads of the OSS, which is a precursor for the CIA. I'm pretty sure Miles, who I consider a friend, is a spy. I hope. But he is a fabulous guy with spectacular stories from the music business. And he's got a great book out. So he is going to be on next week. Okay, Deserted Island. So we're taping this on July 12th, which happens to be the birthday of three people: Julius Caesar, Alexander Hamilton, and Bill Cosby. Mm-hmm. Now, if each of them did an autobiography, Kate, you can vote on this. If each one of them did an autobiography and it was completely, completely truthful, like we gave them the truth serum, or in my case, two shots tequila, and they really did a true, fulsome autobiography, whose would you want to read? Jamie, you go first.
I would pick Julius Caesar, because all I know about Julius Caesar is the Shakespeare play. And it just seems like there's a fascinating story there, and I really would like to hear it firsthand.
Okay, David?
I would go with Alexander Hamilton, because it would allow me to ask, I've been thinking about whether I should say this, but it would allow me to ask someone else besides Mrs. Lincoln if they liked the play.
Awesome. And I just feel like, thanks to Lin-Manuel Miranda, how much more could we ever know about
I know, about but, Hamilton, you know, like, right? Most of, like, it's... All due respect to Ron Chernoff, who wrote a great book about great biography of Hamilton, but it's again a version of the Founding Fathers that's probably not steeped in the reality of the Founding Fathers. So I would like to know what it was like to be an immigrant, right?
In that time.
Who nonetheless became a big deal.
Yeah. And
what that entailed. So
okay. I would go with Bill Cosby, because I think he is a fascinating, fascinating person, who clearly did a lot of very, very objectionable things over many, many, many years with many women, too many women, latest ruling notwithstanding. At the same time, he was a force in the educational arena. Sure. He said and did some important things in his work. I will go to my grave saying, you know, how long can you tread water? It was one of the greatest lines ever on a comedy album, his Think About Noah. I just find him incredibly complex, and I haven't resolved my own feelings about him. So I feel as though I would love to sit down with him with three shots tequila and have him really explain what goes on in that brain. Kate, who would you like to have a real autobiography from?
So I guess I'm going to kind of break a tie here, a three-way tie.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe the correct answer is Julius Caesar.
Because?
Because this is personal, but I think understanding how Rome really worked back then, understanding what that world was, because we have so, you know, we have Gladiator. That's probably like the number one way that I think of that world. I just, the civilization they created, and if Julius Caesar was going to tell us an honest reflection of that and how, you know, democracy was working, or republic, or whichever one that they had, I just think it would just be so revelatory of what that world looked like. And I find that fascinating.
Cool.
You know, I mentioned Shakespeare, but my other big impression of ancient Rome is was the masterpiece theater series, I, Claudius.
Yes.
Which I was
that's a good one.
I used to call I Clav Divs.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Sure.
which is a brilliant series, but it just, it's fascinating when you start thinking about what happened in ancient Rome and what lessons it might hold for today.
There you go. Awesome. Okay, guys. Kate, thank you so much for joining us. Absolutely fabulous. Yeah, everyone should go out and get All the Colors Came Out right away. It's really terrific. David, Jamie, Claude, thank you very much, you guys. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we will see you and hear you next week. And we're out.